Evening, everybody. This is That's Criminal with John Stamp. That's Criminal, where we talk true crime, books, authors, writing, and whatever else crosses my mind that day. Today, I get to talk to retired NYPD detective and author Vic Ferrari. Mr. Ferrari worked 20 years with the NYPD, I believe all in the Bronx, and between patrol, narcotics, and auto theft. He had a pretty storied career, and thank you very much for joining me today, Vic.
Hey, John, thank you very much for having me on your show. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. I got a ton of stuff I'd like to talk to you about. Sure. You know, given the some of your titles, Grand Theft Auto, NYPD Law and Disorder, NYPD's Flying Circus, there's a lot of places to start. But one of the things you mentioned, and I think that's a good way to kick off, is you mentioned that when you first started, you were dropped off in the South Bronx and told to figure it out. And it just, that statement there just speaks to the randomness of police work. So if you want, to give a little background and introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Vic Ferrari. I'm a retired 20-year member of the New York City Police Department. From the time I was 5 years old, I knew I wanted to be a New York City police detective. My mom used to walk me to the movie theater on Saturdays to catch a matinee, and there was a police station around the corner. And I used to walk by, and I used to see the police cars and the cops standing outside, and I was fascinated by it. I was fascinated by the way the cops used to keep their hand on the butt of their gun, the way they were interacting with each other. I would run up to the police cars and look in the windows and look at the equipment. And I knew what I wanted to do. And I'm a Bronx kid, born and raised, grew up in New York City. And by 21, I was in the police academy. And the police academy, they fill your head with a lot of crap. What I quickly figured out early on was the people that were teaching me only had several years more than me. And New York City Police Department, it's an interesting place. So you get a lot of guys early on that are either afraid of the street or they want to study for the sergeant's exam. They want steady hours. They don't want to get rattled with other distractions. So what they'll do is they'll go into training units. So I had a bunch of 24 and 25 year olds who had only, you know, spent minimal time on the street telling me how it is. So then you get out of the police academy, and my dad was a butcher. I didn't know anybody. I didn't go to a cushy precinct. I went to a training unit in the South Bronx, and basically was dropped off on a street in the middle of nowhere with abandoned buildings. One of my first foot posts was on Fulton Avenue off the Cross Bronx Expressway. You can look it up. It was rows and rows and rows of burned out, abandoned six-story walk-up buildings that were abandoned for decades. And I felt like someone dropped me off on Mars. I'm standing there with a nightstick. My sergeant goes, "All right, come in at noon for your meal hour, and then you go back out. Call me if you need anything." And he drives off. I'm like, "Call me if you need anything? I don't know anything." And, you know, crackheads are walking by with shit they stole, you know, trying to sell it. You know, there were some decent people, but I mean, the neighborhood was inhabitable. And people would just come up to you with their problems. And I'm like, "Huh?" So even though I grew up in the Bronx, it was an eye opener with people coming up to me with questions and problems. But, you know, eventually I figured it out. But it took me a while. I was a slow learner. Like in field training, I only had a handful of arrests, and I was kind of apprehensive about putting handcuffs on somebody because I didn't know that it's a big, when you put handcuffs on somebody in the NYPD, there's a ton of procedures and with property and the do's and don'ts and handling prisoners. It was a little overwhelming, but after a while I started figuring things out and I started making a lot of arrests and, you know, I got good evaluations and I worked in numerous units. I worked in various plainclothes units doing pickpockets and robberies. I worked in Manhattan North Narcotics Division doing buy and bust operations for about a year and a half. I wasn't an undercover, but I did purchase drugs on several occasions. I worked in auto larceny units. I was a car guy. I was always in car chases on patrol. I knew how to, the neighborhood I grew up in was basically guys used to steal cars as a rite of passage. And I worked in a gas station. So guys would always come in with stolen cars to, you know, get a couple of dollars worth of gas as a teenager. So I knew what to look for. And I was always a car guy. So my last 10 years, I was a detective in the NYPD's auto crime division, where we worked on chop shops, exporting of stolen vehicles out of the country, changing vehicle identification numbers for resale, mafia chop shops and junkyards, identity theft. So I had a really interesting career. I got to see a lot of wild things and met a lot of interesting people. I'm just lucky enough to get into writing after I retired.
Yeah, that's it's funny when you mentioned it. I always wondered in South Carolina, the police academy, we had one, and it was in Columbia. So all the departments from all over the state, everybody fed into the same class. So where I was in a city, you know, minuscule by your, you know, numbers at NYPD of about 500 people, there'd be guys and girls going through the academy that when they got there, they were it. Like they'd get to their little town and, you know, there's no such thing as field training. And I always, once I got into FTO, I was like, what are those people doing? You know, because like you said, you get out there, you just look around, you're like, where do I start? You know? And what's, you know, what, yeah, the idea of your first, the first time pulling somebody over or the first time going to do a field interrogation, here's like, you know, you're almost like that when you're practicing handcuffing, you know, doing a ninja creep up on your role player, you know, you're not quite sure how to act yet. And that's, well, at least I had it.
Think of it this way, right? So for all the role-playing you do in the police academy, did they ever have one of the instructors have a hypodermic needle in their sock?
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. So, right. So this thing's you quickly figure out in the street. It's like, hey, my man, listen, I'm telling you right now, if you got a spike on you, you had better tell me now. Cause if I get stuck with this, you're not going to have a good night. And usually, you know, the heroin addicts, they'll usually tell you, yeah, I got one in my sock, I got one in my pant leg, or, you know, so, but sometimes they're so out of it, they forget, or they're a scumbag and they're not going to tell you about it. You know, the same is like, I'm sure you guys used to do driver training in the police academy and they got you in this big parking lot and you're driving through cones. Yeah. Well, what about when you got live targets and you're in a car chase and people are stepping out in the street, you know, you're not ramming cars. You know what I mean? In field training, yeah. Because A, they don't want the liability, and B, they don't want to crash up the cars. But, you know, you start learning how to cut people off and pin them in. And, you know, there's a lot of things they just, it's not. And you know, in law enforcement, things just happen that you can't be prepared in field training or the police academy.
Yeah. Yeah. The randomness, I thought I was always the best part of the police work. It was just no idea. Yeah. That's what I always wanted. I wanted a job where who knows what's happening when you go to work. And that's what did it.
But it's constantly evolving.
Yeah. Yeah.
The perps, that, you know, the criminals, they think up new scams, new hiding locations. Like, you know, in the early 90s, the drug dealers started with the traps in the cars. I mean, that was unheard of before, you know, and the Bronx and Manhattan, these Dominican gangs, like these guys should have been engineers for NASA. You know, you'd pull over a car and then you'd see the wiring was off sometimes. And then, you know, you'd have to figure it out, put the car in reverse, put on the AC, touch the defogger, and like all of a sudden, like hydraulic, the dashboard, like James Bond shit, dashboard would open up and you find a kilo or a Mac 10 in there. So it's like police work is, you're always behind the bad guys, like the new scams, like with the cell phones. I remember when cell phones first came out, a couple of guys in my precinct stopped these two guys off the side of the highway with like this high-tech device. And we couldn't figure out what they were doing. What they were doing was they were stealing people's frequencies and SIM card information. Then they were cloning phones. You know what I mean? So like that was a big deal, like the cloning of phones for a while. And then that kind of went by the wayside. It just, you're always learning in law enforcement.
Yeah, the first time you see it, you're like, I'm not really sure this is illegal.
You know? Right. Yeah.
What is this funny box you're carrying? Yep. Yeah. For us, one of the ones like that for me was the dudes that would scan the garage frequencies. I was like, what? Oh. I was like, I don't even know what that is. You know, he's just like, okay, well, you guys are geniuses, but you got to go to jail now. And now that I've figured out what you're doing, but yeah, it's we're always behind the curve. That was just the best part. And I never got to work dedicated auto theft, but that would be my game, my scavenger hunt at midnights. You know, you get that lull between when the bars close and when the sun comes up sometimes. And I would take the hot sheets and I would just start rolling and I would just play the game of you know, which car is stolen. That was just the way I'd make it through those late midnight shifts. I loved it, but I never got into getting to chase down a chop shop or something like that. It was tough to get that authorization to chase where we were. I remember when they'd actually let us go, and it'd take a second and be like, wait a minute, we actually get to chase these guys? It's like, this is going to be awesome. But I can't imagine it in that compact area of New York. Like, how do you manage a car chase when you've got millions of people around you in those tiny streets?
Yeah. So the five boroughs in New York has over 9 million people in it. Okay. And the New York City Police Department at any given time has 35,000 members. There's 77 precincts throughout the five boroughs, and that's not including specialized units that I worked in. Each precinct has between 100 to 500 cops in it. So, I mean, you got a lot of law enforcement, and then there's, like, again, you got specialized units floating around in unmarked cars, narcotics, vice, street crime. I mean, they got units, acronyms and shit that I can't keep up. Yeah. The dirty little secret with the NYPD is we're not allowed to chase stolen cars, but everyone did. Usually you get into a pursuit, you'd run a plate. Central would tell you it's coming back 16, which means stolen. Now everybody's ears are up. And you start, if chasing a stolen car in the five boroughs is an art, because whoever's putting it over, like, we go with two man cars. So you got the driver is now chasing this guy. You've got to be able, you don't want to get the sergeant raised up. And then you don't want to get the duty captain who's floating around to call off the pursuit. So what we would do is we would speak calmly. Central, I'm following a 16 vehicle. Well, you're not following. I mean, you're going 70 miles an hour. We're following a 16 vehicle. Yeah, we're going north on this. But the dispatcher can hear your tires screeching in the background. She can figure out that from you just went from 178 in Webster to 204th in Webster in the blink of an eyelash. That's 30 blocks. I mean, you don't have to be, you know, a mathematician to figure that out. So then the sergeant would try to help you out. He would say, he'd play dumb and go, Central, is that vehicle in pursuit? No, Central. Then the duty captain starts chirping up. So then now, when the cat's out of the bag and the shit hits the fan, right? Now everybody's involved in this chase. And then the duty captain will come over the air and try to terminate pursuit. And I never agreed with this because you could really get somebody hurt. Guys start keying the microphone.
Yep.
And start stepping on the duty captain. So in case something happens, I didn't hear him, right? So what happens at the end of a car chase? Well, if the bad guy doesn't get hurt, too bad, and civilians don't get hurt, and there's no real damage to anything, no one's going to bust your balls about it. But if a civilian gets hurt, a cop gets hurt, the bad guy gets severely injured, they're going to cut your balls off. I mean, you're going to take a hit. And in this day and age, probably lose your job. Back then, you'd get a command discipline, or they'd bring you up in charges, and they wouldn't be looking to take your job, but you might get banged, lose 10 vacation days, or the heaviest hit with the NYPD was 30 in a year, where they would take 30 vacation days and put you on a year of disciplinary probation. And to your point about doing the midnight, we always used to kid around in the midnights. Midnights is big game hunting for cops, right? The day tour shift in most police stations anywhere in the country, it's the old timers that are looking to retire. They show up, they take a report, they don't do much else. The 4 to 12s is usually the young guys that are, you know, they're going to burn themselves out running from job to job to job. They're enjoying themselves. Midnights is usually in between. That's big game hunting, because on the midnights you have three things: cops, cabs, and criminals. That's just right. Floating around. And I'll throw in drunks, but, you know, so that basically, it narrows the field. You know what I mean? It, like, takes a lot of legit people off the playing field. So, like you said, you can concentrate. You want to look for stolen cars. So where do you go? You go by the clubs. You go by the IHOP on the weekends. You go by the short stay motel when you run plates through there. You know, there's a lot of tricks of the trade of looking for a stolen car on the midnights. Well, you can do it on the 4 to 12s too, but you're kind of busy bouncing around between calls. But stolen cars is a lot of fun. If there's young cops out there listening, I mean, read my book, Grand Theft Auto. I give up a lot of tips on what to look for and making stolen car arrests.
Yeah, and that's just it. It was you find a stolen car, that's a good dot, but who knows what's coming with it, you know? Because all that opens it up. At least you're on that search. I love doing that. But understanding, like, I would imagine you would attack that investigation kind of like any other organized crime. I mean, outside of knowing the technical details, I never understood the ins and outs of like the VIN. I know it's compartmentalized, so I couldn't, you know, pull somebody over and look at a VIN and know that it was off. I didn't have that expertise. But otherwise, was it kind of put somebody on the hook and then get into the shop, get into the rest of the organization and just kind of go with it from there?
So anybody that's listening, you own a car, you've got a 17 character alphanumeric vehicle identification number on your dashboard, right? And that VIN number is basically the history of the car. The first digit of the VIN number is where the car was manufactured. So one means the car was manufactured in the United States, two, Canada. I think S is United Kingdom. I haven't done this in 15 years, so please forgive me. The last eight digits of the VIN number is the sequential production number when it's coming off the assembly line. So the last eight would be year, whatever letter that means or number is year. The second digit to that is plant. So P might mean Evanstown, Indiana, where it was made. And then you got the sequential production number. The numbers before that kind of give you it tells you different things about that car, the size engine. Is it a base model? Is it the nice model? So I was an expert on a bunch of cars and I run a VIN. So for argument's sake, I would see a Dodge Caravan. I would run the vehicle identification number. I could tell just looking at that VIN number, is it a Grand Caravan, the nicer one with the leather interior that's longer, or is it a base? So I would run a VIN, I'd run a plate and I'd look at the VIN number on the screen and I go, that VIN number calls for a base model, that's the really nice model. So we would pull them over, start asking them questions. Would you mind opening the door? You'd look at the federal door sticker. Was the door replaced? Is that sticker like a color forms that they printed it themselves? Is the sticker even there, right? So now you're on to it because auto manufacturers don't make mistakes like that. Yeah. And then, if you had probable cause or reasonable suspicion, you'd ask them to come into the station house, or sometimes right in the street, you'd be able to tell the car was stolen. And on every vehicle, there are hidden, you've got engine numbers, you've got block numbers, like Honda's got a shitload of numbers on it. There's numbers stamped on the frame, all sorts of things. And I would know where these confidential numbers are, and I'd get underneath the car or go through the hood with a flashlight and a mirror. I would get that number and run it. And it would come back stolen. So then you got to figure out, does this guy know? Is this guy, did he buy a stolen car unwittingly? Or is he a scumbag that knows he got a good deal? Or did he tag the car himself? On paperwork, if the guy has owned the car for 3 years and the car is stolen 6 months ago, he knows. Crashed his car. He kept the VIN number. He swiped another car, put it on a stolen car. Or, is a guy, we used to get, it'd be funny with the drug dealers, right? You'd stop at some drug dealer that's driving a $75,000 Mercedes and he tell you he paid 10 grand for it. Come on. You know what I mean? So
that's probable cause.
Some people we would just take the car and, oh, by the way, we're really sorry, your vehicle is stolen and we're going to do an investigation to find out who's responsible. Or oftentimes it was the person knew. They didn't do it themselves, but they had someone do it for them and they got a good deal on it.
Yep. And when they run into somebody like you who's actually looking in the exact right spots, you can just kind of see them start sinking down into the driver's seat.
We would totally fuck up their day.
Oh, it's coming.
You were asking about like junkyards. So with the junkyards, like back in the day, like the South Bronx, the Hunts Point section of the Bronx, you had tons of body shops, auto body shops. Now, I hate to say this, but most people that work in the junkyard industry, it's found money. When a car comes in and they don't have a title, someone will bring them a car and there's no title or something. They know there's something wrong with it. So, but if they're going to give the guy $100 and they're going to make 10 times or 20 times or 30 times on the parts, I'm not saying they're sending out teams of steel guys to bring them things, but there are guys that do that. But most auto shop junkyards, they're in on it. So what we would do is sometimes we would sit outside with binoculars and we would just hang out and just watch. If a car goes in with a stolen plate and they close the gate, we'd go get a search warrant for it. Sometimes we would put up poll cameras to watch and we'd watch the cars go in. And a lot of times those were insurance jobs. So a junkyard might not take in cars that are stolen per se, like, professional car thieves are bringing in stolen cars, but if they know people that want to make their cars disappear to get the insurance money, right? So we'd have a camera outside and a car goes in on the 14th of the month And then the 20th of the month, they report it stolen. You know what I mean? We've got the owner of the car on paperwork because we know that car went in there on the 14th and never left. And here they are on the 20th reporting it's stolen, that they lost SOAR at the 19th. We've got them, and we've also got the junkyard chopping it up for them.
Yep. And that's and just looking at that scenario, just the ability working in that specialized unit just to be proactive and be able to just run that city and just, you know, stick to your lane and catch those schemes. That's just one of those rarities in law enforcement. You kind of get carte blanche sometimes. As long as you're producing, making those stats, you can do that kind of thing. You can just come up with a crazy idea and run with it and see how far it plays out.
Yeah. And you're right, because I was lucky because I was in a 120 person unit and I was assigned to the Bronx and Manhattan. We had teams in each borough. But then after I retired from the NYPD, I was a cop in Florida and I was explaining to them, we could set up this insurance fraud scheme. And they were like, oh, this is great. And then when I was explaining to them, they're like, yeah, but we're going to need guys to do that. That's going to take away from patrol. And like, as much as they were like fascinated by what I could set up an insurance fraud case, they couldn't. It was like I was talking quantum physics. It didn't make sense for them. Although they would have gotten a nice splash, but they just didn't have the manpower to pull it off.
Yeah, the math just doesn't work out without those resources. Like you were saying, like a 500 person precinct is bigger than all of CPD when I was there. That's wild. It's kind of hard for where I work to imagine that scale. And I've been to New York City a bunch of times, and it's like literally like you walk around, there's a cop on every corner, and it's just like, man, just the sheer scope of that agency just kind of baffles you, you know. But it also creates all those opportunities for you to get into and just have that creative run. That's the best part of being that detective, is being able to come up with that. We're going to run this crazy idea down and see what happens, you know, and actually having the freedom to do that. That was the best. Yep. That's just so much fun. When it comes to that, was it one of those things where you just kind of learned the observations and stuff, or was it heavy on the source work, or was it kind of just one of those things, I'm going to go sit up on this guy and I'm just going to take him off and just kind of just bringing in those stats?
Well, in auto crime, you basically, as long as the numbers were coming in, now it depended on your supervisor. Like for a while, when I first got there in my office, they just wanted arrests. And that was, I was really good at picking up, we call them straight hits or fresh kills. Something that just stolen. I'm also good at picking off, you know, tag jobs where they change the VIN number. So for a while there, under one supervisor, they just wanted numbers. Then we got another lieutenant in and he wanted cases. So like, okay, we'll give you cases. So that's when we started setting up on the junkyards. We did a case in 99-2000. We had a Chinese military intelligence officer set up in Brooklyn. And basically he got in contact with this Jamaican middleman in the Bronx, and he wanted as many Audi A6s a month as they could steal. So what the Asians did was they rented a warehouse in Brooklyn, and the Jamaican middleman had three or four teams of steel teams. They were exporting between 30 and 40 Audi A6s a month out of the country, out of this Brooklyn warehouse. And they were hitting dealerships like on the weekend, like taking 10 cars at a shot. So inside the warehouse, you had about five or six Asians in there. And what they would do is there'd be a shipping container. The cars would come in. They would drive two cars in the bottom of the container. They would let the air out of the tires so that the cars would sit lower in the container. Then the workers would build a frame above the two cars so they could drive another two cars in. So each container contained between three and four stolen cars. Then what they would do is a truck would show up every couple of days, would drive the truck, drive the container with the stolen Audis in it out to New Jersey. They would go on a train and they would get railed out to, what was it, Long Beach, California, I think. And then they were shipped out to the Pacific Rim. But I mean, these guys were stealing 30 to 40 cars a month. So with the NYPD, we had wiretaps, and there's so many cops there. We had 10 Chinese cops that could speak Mandarin and Cantonese. We had 4 or 5 wiretaps in a room just on the Asians, right? Then some of the thieves were Spanish. We had 3 or 4 detectives monitoring the car thieves, right? So we've got this international stolen car case going, right? And in the meantime, these guys start talking about homicides. Well, we got this guy, we got that, like, holy shit. So, I mean, when we took this case down, I mean, you know, we got the Asians, we got the Jamaican middleman. The Jamaican middleman was paid 5,000 cars per month, $5,000 per car. And then his main steal guy, he was given 1,000. And then he was given the thieves anywhere between 100 to 500. But I mean, we're talking big money.
Yeah.
And once we took the case down, like, we solved probably about 15 homicides and, you know, locked up a lot of bad guys. We did that case with the Westchester County District Attorney's Office. Actually, they were getting hit first, and then they came to us. If you ever watch Fox News, Judge Jeanine.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Well, yep. Hero, that was her office. And she was, I sat in on meetings with her because it was actually her office that prosecuted it. The New York City Police Department was, we were supplementing them because it was too big for them. And we had unlimited resources. Plus, we were getting killed, too, with the Audi. But, I mean, that was a really good case. You can Google it. It's probably around 2000. There's an article called China's Biggest Wheel. And that's about one of the hitmen that we were able to, you know, solve a bunch of homicides on.
Wow. Now, so the... So it interests me, the money, the breakdown. So guy goes out and boosts that A6. And that A6 at the time, what, that 45 to 55?
Yeah, about, yeah, you're more or less. 22 years ago. Yeah, about, yeah.
Yeah, more or less. So the guy who actually boosts it, he gets 100 to 5. The guy who is the go-between between the guy who, the actual thief and the warehouse, gets $1,000. And that all comes out. So the Chinese guys are paying $5,000 per car. That car gets loaded up all the way across the country. Think of the logistics of that. And then when it gets to the Pacific Rim, what's the actual, did you guys,
Shanghai.
Okay. So they're going to Shanghai. What are they actually getting for those cars over in Shanghai?
You're talking about the Chinese, you know, you're going to tell me, no one could tell me that the Chinese government wasn't involved in this or let it go on. And we went to the State Department at the time. They were approached. I didn't, but people on the case, and they were la, 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 la. Nobody wanted to know anything about it.
Nope. It's a delicate situation right there. But yes, I like the retired intel guys just came to New York to open up
living in Brooklyn,
car theft business. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nothing shady there.
Military intelligence officer.
Yep. Yeah. No, he's retired. He's just a citizen.
We let him live here. Right.
That's exactly right. Yep.
I got another story about that. Like, so you're talking about guys. So I did a case. Well, I didn't do a case. I was working on a case. I wasn't the principal, but guys in my office were doing a case, and it was with the DEA. So you had these guys in New York that were big time drug dealers, but they were also involved in selling and purchasing clone cars. So, you know, they had guys in California taking pictures of VIN numbers of expensive cars in California. They would create a VIN kit, right? Wow. And then steal a car in New York. So we had the auto theft angle, but these guys were moving multi kilos. And one of the guys involved in this who got grabbed, who was a confidential informant, was from Venezuela, right? And a big case. I mean, you know, you're talking the DEA, and they were great. They were great to us. And all of a sudden, the CI vanishes. And he turns up on another, the DEA is wonderful. He turns up on another wiretap with the DEA. So they're like, look at this fucking guy. So he's on, you know, he's helping us on this case, but he turns up on another case, right? So then he vanishes. So for a couple of months, we're trying to figure out, did he get whacked, right?
Yeah.
Did he go back to Venezuela, or is he two-timing us? And he figured, we found out about it. Now he's off the grid, right? So with the NYPD, you wear many hats. Just because you're a detective in the auto crime division or you're a detective in narcotics, unless you're doing undercover work, which requires, you're never going to wear a uniform. We call it getting thrown in the bag. They will call you at a moment's notice. We need 10 detectives. I mean, you could be working on something really sensitive. They don't give a fuck. Tomorrow, be in uniform and be down at the UN in direct traffic. I mean, yep. They don't give a rat's ass. Like, tomorrow you're going down to Times Square at New Year's Eve. But I'm working on this. I don't give a shit. That's just the way it is. So a bunch of us are standing. It was the United Nations General Assembly. A bunch of us are standing in front of like the entrance to the UN, and you got a vehicle. We're checking vehicles as they're going into the UN, right? Who's going into the UN in a car with the Venezuelan delegate? The scumbag CI is sitting in a car with government officials. We're like, he's looking at us and we're looking at him, and he's like, holy shit. Like, he's shocked. What the fuck are these guys that I was working with in uniform standing in front of the UN? Like, what are they doing here? And we're like, what the fuck is this guy sitting in a car with diplomatic plate? Yeah. So the DEA took it from there. Like, the case was already pretty much done. Like, he was like the final piece. I don't know what happened with it, but yeah, there's a lot of shit that goes on like that.
Yeah, and I love it. And that just goes into those little random bits of experience that just only working cases can get you. There's the wildest thing seeing.
Oh, dude, had a case. I had a diplomat's husband. She was from Vanuatu. Her husband was a Brit. He imported a stolen car from France to Africa. They slapped diplomatic plates on it, and they're fucking driving around the city. And the security director of the dealership called us up and said, we got a car here that's stolen from France. So I was like, I might not be able to arrest them, but I'm going to steal their fucking car back. So I was working with the dealership to get a key cut. And I went to the State Department, and they were like, no, please don't steal this car because it's going to be an international incident. They talked to the woman, and she couldn't have been nicer. We didn't know. And handed us the car back, and we shipped the car back to France. But I mean, if you work in New York, you see like a lot of shit that'll, you know, it makes you wonder what's going on behind the scenes with these countries.
Yeah, especially, I mean, the State Department, that's their job is to entertain and then, toss American money at foreign problems. And they take that to heart, you know. It's amazing.
Oh, they didn't want me stealing that car back.
Oh, no, nope. They'd much rather have a relationship than justice, yeah. You know.
Would have been at who?
Yeah, right. Wherever that is.
It was, I never heard of that place. And then someone says, I think they did a Survivor episode on that. And I, looked it up. I'm like, okay.
Yeah. I thought you were making like a Marvel Comics reference for a second.
No, it's a country in the South Pacific somewhere.
Wow. That's cool. So pivoting to the books, like we were talking about earlier, I started with, and I love some of these titles, Dickheads, Debauchery, and Other Ingenious Ways to Die. And first of all, anytime I see a George Carlin quote captured someplace, I'm in pretty much. I think that guy's like an American prophet at this point.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that guy's a genius. But I as I was reading it, I told you it was making me chuckle, but it's funny. It's a funny mix of anecdotes and lessons from, at least that's what it appeared, anecdotes and lessons from, overall what you picked up over 20 years, going through things like Dadalacs, mom's minivans, aftermarket morons, which it's funny. I actually thought that was a phase that like, I just hadn't seen anybody with like a Fast and Furious car in a while. And then I started going to Central Florida on the regular, and I was like, oh, that's where they all went. They're all yeah. down there. They're like, oh, the rest of our country doesn't like us. We can, mullets and aftermarket Hondas are gonna kill it in Orlando. So it just makes me chuckle. Every time I go there, I'm just like, how many neons can you put on a Hyundai? I don't understand. But the funniest one I saw was the passage with Elvis kicking the shit out of Michael Jackson in heaven.
Right? Like, Michael Jackson was married to Elvis's daughter. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, if they're in heaven, I mean, he'd want to kick the shit out of him. So I just thought that would be funny. I don't know what made me think of it. I did. And,
it was so random when it kicked off, because you're talking about, when you're in heaven, all the good things, going to a huge party in heaven. And then it's like, oh, I get to meet two kings at once. And it was just so funny. You're during the scenario, Elvis decides to try and kick you in the head, and you're like, oh yeah, you know, when you think about it, you know, she never asked for permission. He's just looking out for his daughter. I was like, okay. I was like, that's a fantastic stream of thought you just threw down there.
We wonder which Elvis I would have run into in heaven. Was it, you know, before the military Elvis, or, you know, it was 15 minutes before he died on the bowl Elvis, you know, the Vegas years. So you really don't know.
Once he went to the sequence, it was like, oh, I don't know, man. I don't think that's a good move. I had a blast with some of these.
Thank you.
Just walking through these, it is just fun to read, because you can tell just all these little scenarios you build into, like, hey, try not to do this. And then and I'm not going to give a bunch of stuff away, but there's one other that caught me was when you had to sit your 17-year-old niece down and warn her about parking, like, don't go wash your car and vacuum it out at 11 o'clock at night.
I explained to her, I said, you know, just because you have a car, you're going to have all this freedom, but now you're on the playing field. She goes, what do you mean? I says, well, I mean, you're coming from your girlfriend's house at 11 o'clock at night. Don't stop at gas at a 7-Eleven and then go, oh, I should check the air in my tire, or I should vacuum it out and pull off to the side where, you know, Lyle, the serial killer, you know, guy that travels by freight train at night, you know, is waiting. You know, people put themselves in play by doing ridiculous things at off hours. I mean, you know, you see things on a midnight, you're like, what the fuck? This is when you're going to do this? You know what I mean? This is, don't be going to Walmart, you know, I unless your kid really needs formula and you got a concealed carry on a midnight. You know what I mean? Just wait till the sun comes up to handle your business.
Yeah, it was funny because my wife and I have that argument like all the time. Like, we'll be driving and rolling through like the DMZ, and she'll be like, you know what, we could use some gas. I'm like, Matt, not here. She's like, what's the big deal? No. And one time we had a stopover in London. We had a pretty short window in London, and I was catching up to her, and it was probably 11:30 at night. So I dropped my bags and we're going to go out and hit the town a little bit. And as we're making our way, we come into this park that looks like a black hole. I mean, it's just, there's no light, there's no nothing. It's just a dead straight shot. And it kind of looks like the entranceway from like pretty intimidating, right? So I'm like, I'm looking here, and she's like, oh, this is such a shortcut, we'll get over to Buckingham Palace over this way. I'm like, that's cool. I'm like, you've walked through here? She's like, well, we walked through here at noon, it's beautiful. I'm like, lady, you're gonna get yourself killed. I'm like, it's London, not even the cops have guns, but like, as my police brain is like, yeah, you're serving us up on a platter.
You ever think maybe Jack the Ripper has a grandson out there, like floating around?
Yeah, like maybe it runs in the family. What are you doing? Ever heard of a streetlight? I'm like, oh man. But
we look at things differently because we see what happens to people that make poor choices.
Yep. Yeah, they just walk themselves in. But it was just funny that some of the things that caught me, I could tell we're thinking along the same lines.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. But when we get into, so you said I shouldn't have started with that one, but I wanted to start at the beginning because I was really looking at that you got Through the Looking Glass, and then you've got NYPD's Flying Circus, and they're all like calling to me because each one of these look like the funniest parts of Choir Boys from Joseph Wamba, you know.
I've been accused of that. You want me to tell you a couple of quick stories from each book?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So NYPD Through the Looking Glass. I'll tell you two quick stories from that one. So there was a guy we used to work with, great guy, but not really that smart. In the NYPD, there were two ways to really get in trouble is to lose your gun and shield. You'll take a heavy hit. Now they might fire you, but back then it was 30 in a year, like I spoke to earlier. So he lived in a shitty neighborhood. He was going out for the night and he hid his gun in the one place no one would look, his oven. Oh, nine beers, 4 hours late, he comes back tipsy, cockeyed, preheats the oven to 425 or whatever, goes to lay down, waiting for the beeper to go off. He's going to make some frozen pizza. Well, what happens when you put a loaded 38 handgun with live rounds in it in the oven? The bullets start exploding. So he had to crawl out of his fucking house and call 911 on himself, Emergency service had to come, clear the house, and his gun basically was, you know, blew up, and the rounds went, all the rounds exploded in his gun and destroyed his gun, and he got 30 in a year. I'll tell you the Hansel and Gretel story. So I used to, in the early 90s, we would go to bars, you know, you're in your 20s, bar hopping, picking up girls and stuff, go to these cop bars. And there was this guy who worked in the next precinct, and he was an amateur magician. So we'd be at the bar talking to girls, and he'd show up and he'd start pulling flowers out of his wrist and giving it to girls. He's pulling fucking coins behind the ears. Basically, this guy is cock blocking us with magic. So I went to his partner, who I actually worked with years later, and I go, would you get him the fuck out of here? And he goes, you know, I wish this guy was as proactive in his police career as he is making balloon animals at kids' parties. So anyway, a couple of weeks later, these two guys, the magician and my old partner, they get called out for a cause to help in a basement of a six-story walk-up. They pull up, they go into the basement, there's two doors. They go to door number one, they start pounding the door, nobody answers. They go to pound on door number two, and just before my partner knocks on the door, the magician, who's lazy, goes, come on, let's get the fuck out of here. We got our radios on. It's midnight. We've made all this noise. There's nobody down here. He goes, no, I want to knock on the door. He goes, come on, let's go. He goes, I'll buy you a cup of coffee, which cops are cheap. Someone wants to buy you a cup of coffee. Okay, fine. They leave. What they didn't know was behind door number two, the super of the building lived there. He was selling coke out of the apartment. Became addicted to the coke, fell behind on his payments to his wholesaler. The wholesaler sent a couple of Yugoslavian hitmen or Albanian hitmen. They did an old gypsy trick. They brought an attractive female who was in on it. They knock on the door. They put the female in front of the door. The guy thinks he's going to get a blowjob or sell some coke. He opens the door. They bum rush him. They shut the door. They're pistol whipping him. Where's the drugs? Where's the money? He has no answers. They shoot the super in the head. They roll him up in a carpet. They take him out of the apartment and they throw him in the furnace. So while he's going up like a Puerto Rican fire log in the furnace, they go back into the apartment and they're ransacking the apartment. Now, the two cops are outside about to knock on that door. So just before they knock on that door, the Albanians come up with a plan. They tell the girl, listen, it's a railroad apartment that goes straight through with apartments off to the side. We're going to hide on either side of these doors. You just start yelling at Yugoslavian and point to the kitchen. When you get past the threshold of this door, throw yourself on the floor. We'll come out from behind. We'll shoot them. We'll kill them. We'll throw them in the the furnace, and we'll be done. They never knock on the door. So about a week or two later, this guy's got family. They're calling the police. What happened to this guy? So what the cops do, the detectives come. They see that there was a call to that apartment that night, the last time he was seen. They bring in my old partner and the magician. And they go, did you notice anything? And they go, yeah, we were going to knock on the door, but we didn't. So, yeah, well, did you notice anything? And my old partner was a great cop. We used to call him Cancer because he killed more people than cancer. But that's another story. He turns around. And he says, you know, we were leaving. When we were just about to leave, there was a car parked on a hydrant. And I gave it a parking ticket. The car that had the ticket belonged to the female. That was the getaway car. So they track down the female, they bring her in, and she just gives it all up, trying to minimize her involvement, but she's fucking involved in it. So then they got the two hitmen, they got her, then they had to go back to the building in the dead of winter and shut the heat off, right, in like February. And then once the incinerator cooled down, they could get the guy's skull and bones out of there. Oh, man. So that's a story from my book, NYPD Through the Looking Glass, and that one's called Last Night a Magician Saved My Life.
But that's just crazy though, how often, and I think it's hard for people to understand sometimes how often we walk into things and we are the last to actually have any idea what's going on. You know, the victim's actually the suspect. The suspect turns into the victim.
Yes, all the time, and people don't realize that. Sometimes, the people that call up that you think you're there to help, they're the scumbags.
Yeah. It's just standard. It's like, okay, well, that didn't turn out the way I expected. You know, if it turns out, and sometimes it's like, well, I made it through that one. Let's see what's next. You know, man. But so the NYPD Law and Disorder. The cover has a. A cop scratching the back of his neck, studying his cruiser, nosed right into a fire hydrant. Is there a story behind that one?
Not particularly, but the NYPD Law and Disorder, it opens up with a chapter called Embarrassing Moments. And I write about a couple of embarrassing things that happened to me on patrol. So in the early 90s, my partner and I are driving around the precinct. It's about 3 o'clock, our shift's going to end at 3:15. So we're just kind of buzzing the precinct like a plane waiting to land, right? Waiting to pull in so the 4-12s can relieve us. I see this gypsy cab drive by with a bunch of young guys in the back seat. One of them's hanging over the front seat, hanging over like by the driver's head. And we had a lot of cab robberies. So I said, you know what? Let's follow that cab. We start following the cab and he starts burning lights. We put on our lights. We start tapping the siren. He pulls over. We get out of the car. We rush up to the back of the car. You got three amigos back there with a shopping bag like a hot potato. They're passing it around. No one wants this fucking bag. The bag rips and there's 4 kilos of coke in it. So we take the hombres out. We bring them into the precinct, right? I'm on top of the world. Like, I walk into the station house. I'm in uniform. I don't work in narcotics. I'm walking around like I won the fucking Stanley Cup. I got all these kilos of coke. Everyone's coming up taking photos. Where did you get this? You know, for a cop to come up with that, that's a big fucking deal in the station house,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Drugs go down to the lab. The hombres go down to court. I'm still in uniform. The NYPD, I don't know what they do now, but back then, that night, you had to go down and speak to a district attorney to file charges, right? So I go down to the courthouse, and the Bronx courthouse, it's in a shitty neighborhood. And back then, there was really no place to eat, but they had just opened up a little shopping mall across the street from the precinct with a food court, just open. I was like, all right, great. I go in there. I go to this little Italian restaurant. I get a chicken parmesan and a soda. I'm in uniform. I'm in this empty food court. And I'm just like, I'm on top of the world. Life couldn't be better, right? My whole life, I've had problems with my stomach. All of a sudden, I'm like, oh, shit, I got to go. Now, the bathroom in the courthouse across the street is a fucking dungeon. And I'm thinking to myself, well, the food court, this is nice and clean. It's going to be like a cathedral, right? So I get myself together. I go into the bathroom. It's clean. No one's ever taken a dump in this place, right? I go into the stall. Cops are going to love this. I take off my gun belt. I put it on the hook on the door. I drop my pants. I'm getting ready for liftoff. And I hear the front door of the bathroom kick in. And there's got to be 4 or 5 teenagers. And they're screaming and yelling. And they're turning on the sinks. They're hitting the hand dryers. I'm like, fuck. You know, yeah, I'm in uniform, but I got my pants down to my ankles, right? Like, I'm not really in a position to tell them to get out. All of a sudden, it goes from bedlam in that bathroom to quiet. And I'm like, did they see a pair of pants in here and decide, all right, it's time to leave and knock this shit off? And it just got eerily quiet. And I'm like, you know what? I better finish what I'm doing and get the fuck out of here, right?
Yeah, or the jackals found you.
Well, I'm like, just before I pull up my pants, I look up. And one of the kids went into the next stall. He jumped up on the toilet and he's reaching over the stall trying to grab my gun belt on the door. So I jump up with my left and try to pull up my pants with my right. I catch him around the neck, like the shirt, and I start pulling him over the stall, right? But when I grabbed him and pulled him, he got a hold of the gun belt because I brought him to me, right? So I went, shit, I let go of my left hand, right? Pants go down to the floor. And I'm just fucking, I'm righty. So I'm at a disadvantage and I'm punching him with my left hand, like a hockey fight. And I'm punching him, let go of the fucking gun belt. I'm punching him, right? While I'm punching him, his friends run into the next stall and they got him by the legs. And now they're pulling him, right? Finally, he drops the gun belt. It goes to the floor, right? But now I got two hands on him and we're pulling. Well, those aluminum doors ain't built for a 125-pound kid. The fucking wall like buckles, right? And he goes over the wall. He's sweaty. I can't hold on to him. He goes over the wall. I grab my gun belt. I put up my pants. I zip them up. I snap on the gun belt. What was that, like 90, 91? So I had a 38 with a Sam Brown gun belt with a swivel holster. I go running out into the food court. There's not a soul except a 300-pound porter who's buffing the floor with a Sony Walkman. So I'm like, yo, I go, did you see a bunch of kids run through here? No, I don't see nothing. I was like, shit. So in the book I write, what was I supposed to do at this point? Call the police on myself? The responding cops from that precinct would have laughed their asses off. I would have been the laughing stock of the Bronx. Had I done that, I said, you know what? Leave it the fuck alone.
Yep.
So that's a story from my book, a chapter from my book, Embarrassing Moments.
Oh man. Yeah, that would have been toilet paper waiting for you at every roll call for like a year.
Oh, I didn't tell a soul that story until I retired.
Okay. Well, I was actually, as you're telling it, I'm thinking of how I would articulate that. You know,
it's gonna look like a douchebag. Anybody slice it, it's gonna be bad.
Yep, there's no way of winning that, explaining hand to hand with a teenager with no pants. Yep. Oh man, that's awesome. That's pretty great. So I you know, usually whenever I have law enforcement, I ask them what's the craziest story they've got to tell, but I think, I don't know. I'm like, what else, man? This is so much fun. I can't wait to dig into the other books. It's fun when we can talk law enforcement and we can talk, you know, mix the realities of law enforcement, like missing an ambush because your partner didn't feel like knocking on a door, and also follow that up with, you know, battling a bunch of teenagers over without any pants on.
Trying to take a dump.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, those are all realities of law enforcement. There's a lot of strategy and tactics that go into figuring out where to go to the bathroom.
Definitely.
Yeah. I would say if anybody was going to start with one, which one would you want them to start with?
I would start with NYPD Law and Disorder, because NYPD Law and Disorder lists all the other books. So, and I think my writing has gotten better as I've been doing this. I mean, all my books have crazy stories, like the NYPD's Flying Circus, Cops, Crime, and Chaos. There's a story in there about a cop stealing a horse and carriage drunk and taking it from a ride through Central Park. He almost got killed. You know what I mean? And the book opens up, me and my partner, we get called out to a short stay motel for calls for help or disturbance. We go up to the door, and just before we knock on the door in the short stay motel, you hear, "Be a man and put it in my ass." And we just fucking lost it. We're like outside the door of this motel room in the Bronx, and we're fucking, I mean, like, I was on my knee. We couldn't stop laughing. So finally, we pulled ourselves together. We start banging on the door, and you hear, "I told you, you're making too much fucking noise," right? This little old man opens the door in boxer shorts. He's got to be 80 years old. His testicles are past his fucking boxer shorts. Like, they're hanging out of his fucking pants. "Yes." I'm like, "Listen, did you call the police?" He goes, "No." I says, "Listen, I know this is embarrassing for you. You got to let me come in. Because for all I know, there's somebody there trapped in a gimp box from Pulp Fiction, right?" Yeah. So we come into the fucking room. He's embarrassed. Granny is laid up in this bed with a comforter up to her nose. And we're like, "Are you guys okay?" "Yeah, yeah." We look through the place quick. We're not looking to bust their balls, but I want to make sure they're all right. So like, "All right, carry on. Take care." And as we're leaving, my partner goes, "Did he put it in your ass?" And she goes, "Wouldn't you like to know?" So, you know, I mean, like you said, you never know what's going to come out of someone's mouth, or this story is just interacting with the public of me putting myself in embarrassing situations. There's a lot of good case stories in there with funny plots and turns. And, you know, I had a great career, and you know, I got a lot of great stories, and I got a lot of great friends that have shared these stories with me and are okay that I write them.
Yep, and they can just keep coming. The funny thing is, as you're telling that one, so as you can probably imagine, you know, we go out and we end up at a dinner party, and just the funniest thing on your mind that maybe happened like there in the last shift, you're just like, "You know what? We're chit-chatting here. This is going to be hilarious." And you tell something like that, and the entire room becomes a vacuum. And you just realize they don't share my humor. have you ever caught yourself
Sure. Yeah. Well, here's the thing. Most cops hang out with cops, you know, like my brother's a cop. You know, I mean, most of my friends are cops. It's just because they're the ones that understand my humor. Now, ironically enough, it was my friends that weren't cops that encouraged me to write these books. And I was so apprehensive because I'm like, the two things that I wanted to make sure of, I didn't want to get anybody in trouble or embarrassed or divorced. Yeah. So, I had a great career. Yeah. Were there people I didn't like? Absolutely. Did I think that there were people that were assholes and scumbags? Absolutely. But I'm not a sour grapes kind of guy. Like, I retired fairly young. I got a great pension. I had a great career. So I don't, even people I don't like, I might write about them, but I change the dates, the locations, the ranks, because I don't want to put a spotlight or embarrass anybody. But yeah, you're right. I mean, sometimes people, well, you know, I get like most of my reviews on Amazon, I'm like between 4.5 out of 5. But every now and then I'll get somebody that, you know, I don't get his humor. And it's like, well, you know, you must be a lot of fun to hang out with. But like you said, I get what you're saying. Like I had, that's happened to me at dinner parties where I've told a story and you get these fucking looks. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you left a turd in the bathroom and forgot to flush. You just get like this look and it's like, sorry.
Yep. Well, we'll try again. Try me next week.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that's just funny. And then you get the, I don't know if you're the same boat, but I'll get the flash of the eyes from the wife when she sees me spinning up. She's like, nope, just shake the head. Nope, not here.
Yeah, the genie's out of the bottle. That would me. You know what I mean? Like she knows what to expect. So it's, you know. Yeah. In for a penny, in for a pound.
That's exactly right. Yeah, she's come to accept a lot. But yeah, we've been going about an hour, and I think we could probably talk for another couple hours just getting through this. But your book, the first one, it's been a lot of fun to read, and it's just it's easy, but you can see there's so much experience behind those little anecdotes that you've got that you're flowing through there. So I can't wait to dig into the rest of them. I guess before I let you go, since you did, you've got that 20 years under your belt. It's a weird time for police to be joining the ranks now. You got any advice for some kid trying to make that decision?
You know, we need good cops, and we've always had good cops. It's society has changed. Law enforcement hasn't changed. I love when they go, oh, we got to train cops more and more train. Come on. There's never been more training than now. There's never been more technology than now. The thing that puts that narrative to shame is a lot of police departments with these body cams, because you got people out there that go, well, this is going to expose the cops for the monsters that they are. And what does the body cam show? Cops begging people to put something down before they have to shoot them, or, you know, cops telling somebody not to do something stupid and they do it. Cops giving somebody a million and one chances not to talk themselves into going to jail. So, you know, it's society's changed. People don't parent their kids anymore, you know, like, my latest book, Confessions of a Catholic High School Graduate, I went to Catholic school and I didn't want to go to Catholic school, but my father said, you know, you're a clown. And if I send you to public school, you're going to be a bigger clown. And the thing is, growing up as a child, I was a wild kid. Like, we used to play with fireworks and do all sorts of crazy shit. And the thing is, like, the cops would show up every now and then. And if they told us to take a walk and we didn't, we'd get a kick in the ass. A couple of times I got smacked around by the cops. A couple of times I got thrown in the back of a radio car and dropped off in the South Bronx and had to make it home. And the same is in Catholic school when I would catch a smack once in a while. If I went and told my father, the cops gave me a smack, or brother or father so-and-so gave me a smack, my father would say, what did you do? And what is every kid going to say when they get caught? Nothing. So you're telling me that nothing, that he just came up to you, yeah, it was somebody else. And I know what my father would have said. My dad would have said, listen, Vic, I'm going to go and talk to that cop, or I'm going to go and talk to that priest. If their story is more believable than yours, Jesus Christ is not going to be able to save you. So I knew at an early age, you know what? I'm going to fuck around and have a good time. But if I get caught, it's on me. I'm not going to go run into my parents about it, because it's not worth the cost of doing business. It's going to be a bigger penalty. But that was, my parents were like, my parents knew that I was a pain in the ass kid. They love me, but they also knew boys will be boys. They're going to get into trouble. And when they get correct, listen, if I came home with a broken arm, yeah, my father want to kill somebody. But at the same time, you know, I would have been in more trouble coming home and telling my parents about it. And I think in society nowadays, everybody, you know, it's people want to blame the cop. You know what I mean? But you know what? It's backfiring, because nowadays cops now are putting paper on people, and people are getting arrested for things that back then they would have gotten a kick in the ass for.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like, a kid can fuck up his life very early now, getting into trouble. The cop, his hands are tied. Cop can't yell at him. Cop can't threaten him. Cop can't give him a kick in the ass. cop puts him in and he goes to juvie hall, or the kid gets a referral, or depending on the police department, every place is different. Now the kid's got a record. Now the parents got to hire a lawyer. Now the parents are going to lose their kid. Now the parents got to go to a guidance counselor. It's gotten crazy.
Yep. Yeah. Their lack of expectations anymore is just
right.
And the rule always was for me, much like you, is I was always told, if you end up in jail, this number should be the last one you call. It's like, okay. But discretion has evaporated simply because of all the pressure to, you got to be out first in front of that potential narrative. So you got to put paper on people. Otherwise you have no idea what complaint's coming tomorrow. And I remember it was in the 2000s, I could catch some kids acting up. I'd be like, do you want me to take you to jail or do you want to call your mom? And they would, it would take them a minute to figure that out, what the worst course of action was. But even you can't do that anymore. You couldn't turn them over to call the parent, tell them to come get them from where they're at and explain and make the kids explain what they're doing. That still come back to bite you. So yeah, the lack of discretion, it's hard, but I mean, I'd love to see the statistics. Everybody loves to nail us when the body cam doesn't look right, but I'd love to see the statistics of, proper use of authority and procedure versus the violations of policy, and see what the statistics are on those. But that'll never be told. I'd also love to see some legislation where if you're going to put a body cam image on, you need the entire context without edit.
Yeah.
I don't see that either, but that's a rant. That's a burgeoning rant.
Yeah. I retired before that shit.
Yeah. I never had to deal with body cams either. But anyway, I appreciate it. It's a Tuesday night, and I imagine you got to get to your neurotic Irish wolfhound. According to your bio. Oh,
God. So, I can hear him whining in the background.
Yeah, luckily my guy's so old, he just chills with me. He only gets upset if somebody leaves dinner on the table. So I don't have that one. He's just old and lazy. But Vic, I appreciate you joining me. And anytime you want to join me, I'm sure we could just pick this conversation right up, man.
Listen, if anytime you go through one of my books and you want to talk, reach out. I'll come on.
Oh, outstanding. Outstanding. I'll be taking you up on that. I think absolutely. I'm going to go with Law and Disorder next. And then we'll come back and chat on it. But thanks again.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us. And actually, Vic, you got any socials or anything you want to
put out there? If all my books are available on Amazon, they're all paperback. They're $10. For paperback, $2.99 ebook download. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at VicFerrari50. I'm on Facebook. I don't know the address. Just look up Vic Ferrari. It's a picture of me from 25 years ago in a police uniform. You figure it out. You got any questions about my books or other podcasters want me for an interview? I never turn podcasts down. People like you were nice enough to put me on your platforms and enables me to move books. So I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And you can tell I'm kind of new at this. I almost forgot to let you put out your links. I'm figuring it out as I go. But hey, thanks a lot, and everybody, we'll talk to you next week.